This week on the Best of Flashpoints, death row prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal on his reaction to the election of Barack Obama. A special report on the murder of U.S. independent journalist Brad Will 2 years ago in Oaxaca, Mexico. And we rebroadcast an interview with the late legendary author and broadcaster Studs Terkel. All this with Dennis Bernstein and JR coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You are listening to POCC Black Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR. Days ago, Barack Obama was selected to be the first black president of the United States, one of the most powerful jobs on the planet. Today on the Black Report, we are going to Pennsylvania's death row to talk to former Black Panther, prolific journalist, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal about his opinions on the recent happenings.
Hey, what's going on, Moo?
What's happening, black man?
Man, I'm good. How are you under the circumstances?
Hey, look, you know, another day in hell.
I hear it. So I just had a few questions in regards to the selections. We could just jump right in. As of January 10th, 2009, Barack Obama will be the president of the United States. What is your opinion on this outcome?
I'm not surprised. I am surprised by the scope of it. And I think the scope speaks of a kind of hunger in many American hearts. I think it's also a referendum on the last four and then the four before of the Bush regime. You know, sitting president now, George W. Bush, really, really alienated a good number of people all across all sectors of American life. And I think that all the stars aligned for Barack Obama. And that's why I think he resisted running, say, 4 years from now, as opposed to 2008.
Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. equated Barack Obama becoming president of the United States to the South African presidency of Nelson Mandela, where nothing changed but the color of white power's representative. What is your assessment of this comparison?
Well, unfortunately, I think his comparison may prove quite apt. There is a relatively new book going around called The Incognito, and it's written by a younger man named Frank B. Wilderson. Frank B. Wilderson is an English professor, a poet, a writer, of course, but he spent several years in South Africa as a member of the ANC. So he gives kind of an inside flavor of what the presidency of Nelson Mandela actually meant to members of the ANC, members of the youth wing, member of the armed wing, and also for the poor, you know, in South Africa. Needless to say, for millions of people in South Africa, they're living in poverty. They're living in ghettos by any other name. Some still don't have running water, don't have electricity. Millions don't have decent housing. But the rich who were rich before the change of government are richer after the change of government. And what has happened is what South Africa fought for many years was to create what they called a quote-unquote colored buffer zone between the masses of the people and the very rich. Now they have that buffer zone. It's just blacks, you see. And so the class differentiation between then and now is very, very stark.
How do you think the international community will respond to U.S. imperialism and blackface?
I think if what we are seeing on TV is any true indication, they will celebrate. They will celebrate. And, you know, I guess what I should have said also and added to your prior point and question was that it doesn't depend on them. It depends on us. If people organize, they can make change, but they can't kind of lay down and say, well, you know.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Green and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Well, because of this election, we's free now. You know, there's still millions of, you know, people living in hells in America right now, living far worse now than they were, say, a year ago. You know, the hardest hit communities for foreclosures were African Americans and Latinos because they were suckered into those exploding mortgage, the ARMs, the adjustable rate mortgages with balloon payments and so forth. Look at the incarceration rate. But, you know, then look at education. I mean, after all of this progress, progress happens on a political level. It's symbolic, you see. But on a daily lived level, where most of us are, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1970, 71. You know, you can go to any black community. You can go to Philadelphia. You can go to Roxbury. You can go to Pittsburgh. And, you know, the schools are blacker than ever. And the education, frankly, for the young generation is worse now than it was in the 70s. See, you know, under a segregated system, what you had all across black America were extremely well-educated teachers. They were there because they could not work in white universities or in white schools. You had black schools in the South where many of the teachers had master's degrees or PhDs. As they would go up north, get their education, come back south, but they couldn't work in a public school system. They could only work in black schools. You have nothing close to that now. You know, now people run away from the public schools. Now, charter school is the way the state has been pushing people. They're making it into a private business. You remember Bush's famous words from several years ago, this is an ownership society. Well, that's what they tried to do. And if you didn't have capital, if you didn't own anything, well, you were on your own. And now we see where that's got us.
Most voters in the United States have no knowledge of the Electoral College or its function. Can you explain to us what it is?
Well, it's really a device placed into the Constitution that allows a small group of people, they call it an Electoral College, it's not a real college, but a small group of people called electors, who actually cast the formal votes for who shall be president and vice president. I mean, it may surprise people, but in point of fact, people did not vote for Barack Obama or John McCain. They voted for electors who will decide when they gather together who will receive the delegates among those electors. They do the actual voting. And this was a device put in to the Constitution so that America didn't get too much direct democracy.
Some people in the revolutionary community feel that Obama being president is a setback because it will allow the establishment to deny racism still exists in America. But the late, great Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, said that neocolonialism is the last stage of capitalism. What are your thoughts on the issue?
I would refer to what I said above and earlier, that people can't take shortcuts to organizing. Well, even with the Obama victory, if you recall the Republican convention after the Democratic convention, one of the best mocking lines that they used, and I remember specifically the former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, they joked about Obama being a community organizer. Well, in point of fact, he was a community organizer, and he used those skills to beat the hell out of anybody who was his opponent. No one expected him. I mean, I remember in November 2007, no one expected him to beat Hillary Clinton. Hillary was going to be the next Democratic nominee. No one expected this guy to beat him. And when you looked at the Republican convention and how the polls changed after it, everybody expected John McCain to be a stronger candidate coming out of the convention. But this was a community organizer. So people who call themselves revolutionaries, who are organizers and activists and agitators, take the lesson about what community organizing really is. That's talking to people, organizing people, and making change. I mean, that's where change really happens. You know, talking to real people, changing their minds, bringing them over, and organizing them.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Green and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Well, Kwame Ture used to say every time he spoke to people, at least three times, he would say, you must organize, organize, organize. I mean, he would beat that drum until, you know, it was deeply embedded in consciousness. He understood that unless people understood how to organize and then did that, then there will be no change. I'm not just talking about political change. I'm talking about real social change. So our people need to organize, organize, organize.
If you were allowed to vote, would you have voted? Why or why not?
I probably would have. I mean, my mother was a judge of elections, and I voted from when I was very young, so I did have that habit. There were several times I didn't, but, you know, usually it was a deeply embedded habit. I would probably have voted for Cynthia McKinney, who represented a true radical alternative. I mean, here was a black woman black woman who stood up very strong in Congress against the Iraq War and against the Patriot Act and against a lot of the repressive measures that her fellow Democrats voted for. Well, because she stood up, she was isolated by the Democratic Party. And really, I think she suffered two electoral defeats because she was so outspoken. It was the Green Party that was a fit for her. And, you know, this was a black woman. I mean, if a black man is progress, a black woman is real progress. But again, I mean, organize.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Organize. We can't understate the importance of organizing.
Definitely, man. Well, thank you for doing the interview. And
thank you, Brother JR.
You know, just let us know what's needed on our end that can contribute, man. And we with it, man. We there.
Organize.
No doubt.
You were just listening to the voice of political prisoner and prolific journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal as we discussed the presidential selection of Barack Obama and its impact on the planet. On the Block Report with the Minister of Information, J.R. If you would like to hear more from Mumia, you could go to prisonradio.net. And if you would like to hear more from The Block Report, you can hit up www.blockreportradio.com. What's the call? Free them all. We out.
We ain't vote to get into this, so we won't vote to get out. We ain't vote to get into this, so we won't vote to get out. We ain't vote to get into this, so we won't vote to get out. We ain't vote to get into this, so we won't vote to get out.
We didn't vote to be colonized and enslaved. We didn't vote to be tamed. We didn't vote to suppress our rage and be trained. We didn't vote to be driven insane. We didn't vote to be disproportionately jailed. We didn't vote to be nailed to a cross daily and tragically killed. We didn't vote to be the guinea pigs for the birth control pill, or to be given syphilis by the soulless and denied medication while we lie ill. We didn't vote to be the first played, the last paid, and the last saved in the last days. We didn't vote to be stripped of our dignity and become afraid. We didn't vote to end fighting for liberty, for it is still necessary by any means.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Mexican authorities blame the death of Brad Will on the Oaxacan activists and a photographer who tried to save the American journalist's life. Will was shot during a protest on October 27, 2006, while filming a violent clash between armed civilian-clad municipal police and members of the Oaxaca People's Assembly. It was a time of mass protest and a major uprising by teachers and workers and their supporters against the entrenched corruption of the longtime PRI governor. There's clear evidence that Will was in fact killed by police and government-related officials, and that the activists did everything in their power to save the young journalist's life after he was shot down. Joining us to talk about the story's Flashpoint special correspondent, John Gibler. Gibler is the author of the forthcoming Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. He is also a Global Exchange Media Fellow and writes regularly from Mexico. John, good to have you in the studio.
It's great to be here.
You know a great deal about this case because you've been working actually as a translator, right?
Correct. I've been volunteering as the interpreter, legal interpreter for the Will family, Brad's parents, Kathy and Hardy, in all of their meetings with both state and federal officials in Mexico. So I've been present both in 2007, 2008.
Take us back to 2006, set the scene, and give us a sense of what the atmospheric pressure was at the time. You were certainly doing a lot of reporting for us about what was going on.
Exactly. We'd been covering the story on Flashpoints for several months when Brad was killed in late October 27, 2006. The first thing that's very important here is to really say quite clearly that Brad's murder was an unnecessary murder, a particularly unnecessary murder in the sense that it should never have happened. Paramilitaries had been photographed and filmed in the streets of Oaxaca killing protesters for months. We'd covered that story on Flashpoints. The story had been shown on national television in Mexico. Imagine the scenes of 40 pickup trucks with men wearing ski masks and carrying AR-15 assault rifles shooting at protesters in the street at night. Those scenes had a devastating impact in Mexico and Mexican society. The disgust at the state governor Ulysses Ruiz use of what seemed like, you know, a 1970s Central American dictatorship response to the teachers' uprising. The teachers' movement had been peaceful from the very beginning. They built tent cities in the downtown area. And once the governor sent the paramilitaries out, that's when they began to construct the barricades that are now famous as a social phenomenon in Oaxaca, hundreds upon hundreds of barricades built throughout the city. That was actually the movement's commitment to peaceful protest. Instead of responding with guns to the armed paramilitaries, they responded with social organization by taking to the streets and blocking them with whatever they had at hand. In that context, on October 27th, armed men, some were police in civilian clothes, some were local city councilmen, one was a judge, they attacked a barricade with handguns and rifles, the barricade on a street named Calicanto. Brad immediately went to the scene with APO activists to film the activists' defense of the barricade, a defense with rocks. They had these bottle rockets they would kind of clumsily shoot in the general direction just to scare the paramilitaries who were trying to advance down the street and shoot at them. One thing that was very characteristic of the APO movement was that they didn't get scared easily. When the paramilitaries came out, instead of hiding under their beds, which would be a very logical response, people took to the streets, and people took to the streets in huge numbers and in an organized fashion. They pushed the paramilitaries three blocks away from that original barricade. And it was at that moment on a street known as Juarez Street where the paramilitaries were shooting at the APO protesters from behind a red dump truck, which had been parked across the street to block off the street. Several photographers were actually shot at, and one was shot before Brad was killed. Valdo Ramirez was a photographer for the Mexican national daily Milenio, received a gunshot wound in the leg and was carried around the corner. The El Universal reporter, Raul Estrella, actually took the now very famous photographs where he's with a zoom lens taking picture of a paramilitary shooting directly at him. The bullet whizzed right by his head, and that's when he said, that's enough for me, I've got my shot. He went around the corner of Juarez Street, and only moments later, Brad was shot dead and carried around the corner himself. The days immediately after the killing, no one questioned who did it, because it was so obvious. There had been national and international press there with cameras, with video cameras. They had taken photographs of the people from the Santa Lucia municipality shooting at them.
We're looking at one right here, right? Are these the culprits here?
Exactly. There's a now famous photograph which you can access. The radio listeners can go to theindependent.org, where that's spelled I-N-D-Y, P-E-N-D-E-N-T, independent.org. And there we've reposted some of these incredible photographs where, again, Raul Estrella from El Universal, which is a very centrist paper, by the way, it's a national paper, very kind of center political line, they published these photographs on the front page on October 28th, 2006. And all the men were clearly identified, their government positions.
We know their names, their positions.
Their names, their address.
Do we know the weapons they were holding?
The weapons they were holding. They were holding 38 revolvers. One of them had a rifle. All of this information is known. All of them are still working in the government. They haven't even lost their jobs, much less gone to jail or in any way had to be held accountable.
Well, they were initially taken into custody, but they were released because of some what?
Well, it's very funny. Actually, the state government said that they were in jail. But a friend of mine, Diego Sorno, from the Milenio newspaper, went to go interview them in jail and realized no one was there. So he published a story saying they aren't in jail. And the state government rushed to go get them and take them off to the jail
and
cell.
Put them in jail.
Exactly, so that they could say, no, in fact, they are. But only a few days later, the state attorney general, Lisbeth Caña, released them, saying they had carried 38 revolvers. And Brad was killed with a 9mm pistol. So she said, the state attorney general of Oaxaca said these paramilitaries could not be his killer because they did not use the same caliber weapon. We now know 2 years later conclusively that in fact the lethal weapon used to assassinate Brad Will was a 38 revolver. The Mexican National Human Rights Commission, the International Group Physicians for Human Rights, and even the Mexican federal attorney general all acknowledge now that Brad was killed with a .38 revolver. So the very gun these paramilitaries had, the very reason that the state used to justify releasing them, that is, in fact, the same caliber weapon that was used to kill Brad Will.
Wow. Let's stay with the story of the men in the photograph who are now identified. How can we characterize their relationship with the governor, with the entrenched government, which had everything to lose by these growing protests?
Very good question. Exactly when the teachers rise up and the governor of Oaxaca, Ulysses Reese, brutally represses them on June 14th, entire Oaxacan society takes to the street to support the teachers. And their movement then goes beyond the initial teacher strike to become this broad, popular Oaxaca assembly movement known as the APO. Well, an interesting phenomenon there is the very traditionally, famously, you know, fractured left in Oaxaca, all of a sudden they all came together and they all acted together. And the power of that movement was that union, precisely. Well, a parallel phenomenon happened on the state government side. When Ulysses Ruiz was under threat, when it was imminently possible that a protest movement, an unarmed peaceful protest movement, would dislodge him from power, would oust him from the governor's office, then Ulysses Ruiz pulled ranks. He called on the long-ruling PRI political party in Mexico, which in Oaxaca has been ruling uninterruptedly for over 80 years since the party was created. He called ranks and pulled people from local governments, local police, state police, and pretty much forced them to participate in these death squads and in these armed attacks against the protesters. So there is, you could say that Ulysses Ruiz was acting in a sense as a general in a you know, de facto state of siege, in which he called upon police, judges, city councilmen, anyone within the PR party, said, you know, grab your gun. So it's those local police, local city councilmen, and a judge take to the street that day in October with guns in hand and open fire on the protesters, wounding six activists, one photographer, and fatally wounding Brad Will.
All right, let's talk about what happened recently. The Mexican government, given all that we've said, all the people who tried to help Brad Will were essentially indicted.
It is an amazing display of the desperation, the incompetence, the exquisite incompetence of the Mexican federal government. The fact that in their attempt to at all costs cover up their official complicity in this murder, they're carrying out this murder through these local officials, that they have used all the photographs of Brad as he was being carried away from the line of fire to identify those people in those photographs as his killers. So as you said, precisely the people who risked their own lives to jump out into the street, to pick Brad up, to carry him around the corner, to try and give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, to help him take off his shirt because Brad, the witnesses have told me, he was in the moments that he could still move, he was desperate to see what had just happened to him. So he started trying to lift his shirt as if to look at his own wound. And the people that rushed to his aid and tried to save his life and take him to the hospital, who were widely photographed, these are the ones the federal government has just identified as being his killers.
And his camera kept filming as it fell, right?
Exactly. And that video has been used by an independent video forensics analyst as well as the Mexican National Human Rights Commission to disprove the impossible and absurd claims of the Mexican federal government that his killers were the people standing next to him.
How was it used? What did it show?
The Mexican National Human Rights Commission has done a sound analysis to identify the sound of the fatal shot and then the first moment that the high-definition camera starts to blur. So that's the time elapsed between the shot being fired, the sound traveling, of course, right, to the camera microphone, and then the bullet traveling to hit Brad's chest and make him fall. Since it's a high-definition camera which records each frame within, you know, hundredths of a millisecond, the Mexican Human Rights Commission has been able to gauge an approximate distance that the bullet would have traveled, knowing that it was a 38 caliber bullet, studying the weight of those caliber bullets, the kinds of handguns used to fire them, and through a comparative analysis of these different kinds of handguns with the same caliber bullet, they came up with a distance of between 35 and 50 meters, which is about over 100 feet.
Let me tell you, listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with John Gibler about the killing of independent journalist, U.S. journalist from New York City, Brad Will, 2 years ago in Oaxaca, Mexico. Let me ask you a little bit more, John, about the people by name who were, in fact, indicted. How many? Are they in jail now? What are they saying?
There are 9 people for whom the federal government has issued arrest warrants. Only one has been detained and is in jail, Juan Manuel Martinez. These were all people who were participating in the APO movement. Some were teachers, one was a doctor, one was a student, one was a member of an indigenous rights organization. One, however, is a photographer. Gustavo Vilchis was documenting the Oaxaca conflict for the local Mexican Human Rights League, a nonprofit organization based in Oaxaca that did an amazing job and very risky job of documenting human rights abuses during the 2006 conflict. And he was around the corner as a group of people carried Brad to Arboles Street from Juarez Street. He knew Brad. They hung out a lot. They were both photographers. And he rushed to his aid. He tried to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and then helped carry him to a Volkswagen Beetle that was used to try and take him off to the hospital. Gustavo, it turns out, is actually in the United States right now. He is participating in a book tour, a book called Teaching Rebellion, which has just been published by PM Press here out of Oakland. That book is an amazing collection of testimonies of people who directly participated in the Oaxaca movement, as well as photographs, and a large number of Gustavo's photographs, as well as his testimony are in that book. So he is here in the United States touring with this book when he finds out he has an arrest warrant issued for him back in Mexico.
And what's his crime? Is it conspiracy to commit
murder? He is being charged with conspiracy to cover up murder. So they're charging Juan Manuel with being the gunman, the man who pulled the trigger, and they're charging everyone else who tried to help Brad. All those people are the ones they're charging with conspiracy to cover up the murder.
Wow. Now, what has been the response? I know it's been strong from the family of Brad Will.
They think it's insulting. They're completely appalled because not only is the federal government not carrying out its basic responsibility of ensuring justice, not investigating in a serious, impartial manner the death of their son, but they are actually going after the people who tried to save him. And not only that, but they're forcing Brad's parents, his own family, to defend innocent people that the government is trying to charge. So now the Will family is not just, you know, a family suffering through something unimaginable, the murder of their loved one, the murder of their son, their brother. They're having to become defense attorneys. They tried to work with the Mexican government. I was at the meeting. The first meeting was 12 hours long in Oaxaca back in March 2007, when both Kathy and Hardy finally felt, you know, thank goodness the federal government is going to take over this case and the corrupt state government is going to have nothing to do with it. And they believed and they wanted to believe in the integrity of the Mexican federal government. Well, sadly, a year and a half later, they have learned to lose that belief. The Mexican federal government is participating actively in the cover-up of the real culprits of Brad's murder. They are planning to take a very strong role in putting social pressure from the United States. The Merida Initiative, which is a package, it's kind of a Plan Mexico, a package of $1.4 billion in military and police aid from the United States government to the Mexican government, that bill was signed into law on July 1st with a condition that the State Department of the United States produce a report within 3 months concerning Brad Will's murder investigation. Well, the 3 months have long since passed, and the murder investigation has long since collapsed. And the Will family, they're telling me that they are going to pressure Congress, including their local congressman, a Republican who wrote a very strong letter supporting them and demanding a serious investigation, actually calling for Congress to hold all of the military aid, to freeze those funds and not give them to the Mexican government until justice is done.
Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen, because you could sort of call this free trade aid. They need a military structure to impose lots of different aspects of border activity. That's a whole nother subject, but I guess this does... I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to, John.
Sounds good.
And I know you must have thought about this, but we spoke to you about another situation, which I think happened in San Salvador at Deatenco. An activist was shot through
Correct.
The head. And I believe we interviewed you in the van on the way to the hospital.
Correct.
Right? Where the guy ultimately died. And he was a victim of Mexican government authorities, right?
Correct.
You know where I'm going with this?
I can imagine.
You know what I'm saying? We're in jeopardy here. Journalists are in jeopardy. Is this action, is it effective? Did they kill Brad Will and indict these nine so that they can restrain, undermine this kind of uprising again? What should we take in terms of precedent?
I was speaking with Gustavo, the photographer who tried to help Brad, and he was telling me, you know, he noticed in that moment he was the only person with a camera who was doing something. There was this line, and there's actually a photograph of all the national newspaper photographers and the international photographers just staring dumbstruck at Brad on the ground, bleeding to death. Gustavo was holding Brad's head in his hand and trying to save his life. And he kind of had this just flash moment that he really only became consciously aware of later, right, in retrospect, that he was aware, like, I'm jeopardizing myself by being here. Like, all the other guys with the cameras, they're all standing over there watching. Most of them not even taking pictures anymore because they're so, you know, struck by what's happening and the gravity of what's happening, the intensity of what's happening. But Gustavo's like, you know, that's something that in a moment's notice, it's either you pull yourself out or you jump in. You know, you stand in solidarity with someone who's on the ground, with someone who's been struck. And he doesn't regret it, and neither do I. The Brad Will case is very unique because in all of the other assassinations, some 23 people were assassinated just in the Oaxaca 2006 conflict. There's not a single other murder that's being investigated by the Oaxaca state government or the Mexican federal government. The Oaxacans who were shot in cold blood in their peaceful uprising, their murders are not being investigated. They apparently don't consist of crimes. For the Mexican government, I think they're going through the motions rather pathetically with this investigation in Brad's case because he was a foreign national, because he's a United States citizen. In their case, an incredibly shoddy and insulting fabricated investigation. What I think is a kind of ritual incompetence, an incompetence that is done on purpose, that is crafted over time. In Brad's case, no one went to the crime scene until 4 days after the murder. No one preserved the crime scene. The caliber of bullet was misidentified. The autopsy was not finished. No one from either the state or federal government interrogated the men who were photographed shooting that day. The two indigenous radio hosts, the Triqui women radio hosts, Felicitas and Teresa from Oaxaca, who were gunned down with AK-47s on the highway back in April 7 of this year, 2008. There's no investigation in their murder. They were gunned down on the street, and I interviewed the man who was driving their car. He saw the people who shot them. He gave me their names. He identified them. No federal or state investigator even went to take his testimony. As they say in Mexico, and I quote, spurious President Felipe Calderon, end quote, he is obsessed with this concept of the rule of law. But there is no rule of law. The rule of law is a kind of ideological device meant to construct a fantasy of democracy that does not actually exist. Mexico is a society crafted around the rule of impunity.
Tall ships all along the pier lines, like the tracks of tears for the lost glory of New Amsterdam. Flanked by silver scrapers of the New Jerusalem makers, the old New York, they didn't give a damn. Some built their dreams in arcs of light, some in sacrilege. Across the Brooklyn Bridge, across the Brooklyn Bridge. How I love to listen to the wind through her strings. How I love to hear her sing.
In Berkeley, I'm Emily Howard. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The award-winning political writer, radio broadcast personality, and historian Studs Terkel passed away on October 31, 2008, at the age of 96. Terkel is best remembered for his oral histories of common Americans. We now feature an interview between Dennis Bernstein and Studs Terkel from 2005.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. According to the Wikipedia, an online encyclopedia, Mr. Louis Studs Terkel was born May 6, 1912. They list him as a writer and a broadcaster. Indeed a broadcaster, a writer. For over five decades, Terkel has had his ear to the ground, listening, taking notes, talking to the people who are making history as it's happening. Listening to his list of books, Giants of Jazz, 1957 Working, the extraordinary landmark workbook that honored the importance of the worker whose hands are on everything we touch, and on they go, Division Street, America, Hard Times, The Good War, Chicago, other books, that amazing work, Race, What Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. What a career. Now at 93, Louis Studs Terkel returns to the subject of his first book in part, that love of performance of music. This new book is called And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. It is great to have you on the show again, Studs Terkel.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very gracious introduction.
Well, it's all yours. You did it all, and I guess the work continues. Now, you know, in this new work, you share extraordinary dialogues with musicians, singers, composers, A to Z, among the most significant and impactful artists of our time. Dizzy Gillespie, Pete Seeger, Marian Anderson, Mahalia Jackson, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin. And I don't know whether to start alphabetically or by the magnitude of contribution, but how about this way? Maybe we could start with my namesake, Leonard Bernstein. How did you meet Leonard Bernstein? Why did you think he was significant?
Well, I knew of him. We knew of one another. I knew of him more than he knew of me. But through the years, and I was always taken with his generosity of spirit, his multi-giftedness, not simply as a maestro. Almost every singer I know in the classical music world, but also in the popular world, all said working with him lifted their spirits immediately. They were buoyant as they never felt before. He was a teacher. He was a composer. He was everything, but mostly he appreciated the music of his contemporaries. And what moved me most during our conversation, it was a long conversation, I hope I caught certain key moments in it, in this book, is that as soon as I mentioned the name of Mark Blitzstein, it's a name few people know, it was during the days of the Great Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt was president, and the free market as we know it today fell on its fanny with the crash of Wall Street, 1929. And the big shots, the wise men of Wall Street, didn't know what hit them. Along came the government, benign, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Henry Wallace, Secretary of Agriculture, and Harold Ickes and Madam Perkins of Labor. Well, these people all had a sense of history and need, and the government played a role in saving their hides. And so the very grandchildren of the ones whose hides were saved are the ones who most condemn big government. That is, especially when it comes to health and education and welfare. Not expenditures on the Pentagon, of course, or breaks with the big boys. So I'm obsessed with the idea of we're possessed for the moment, although we're overcoming it, a national Alzheimer's disease, as though there was no yesterday, as there was no depression, of which a government that cared pulled us out of it, in contrast to today, as you see. So,
Studs, let me just jump in, Studs. You know, Leonard Bernstein took a lot of criticism because he got political, because he supported the Black Liberation Movement. What do you think about artists participating in politics? Like that,
artist has much a right to participate in politics. Archibald MacLeish was the great poet laureate of our country at the time, Librarian of Congress. He supported Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. Carl Sandburg did. This is, since when is a person being an artist having less right than anybody else? We always quote big shots in the world of industry, don't we? How about big shots in the world of art and music, of which we need? That's part of the bread of life, as much as bread and wine may be. And so since when are they deprived of their rights to speak as well as anyone else? And so this is part of this phony idea of liberal media, which, of course, the phrase itself is an assault upon our intelligence. I'm talking about the intelligence of ordinary people who are now catching on, we can tell by the polls. It's an assault upon the sense of decency, liberal media. Who was the name most associated for years with public radio? It was Bill Buckley, of course. You got McLaughlin. You've got Novak. And you would think that Noam Chomsky was on every night. And so yet this phrase is used by these neo-Neanderthals who've come to that stage.
We are speaking.
There's a catching on now.
We're speaking with Studs Terkel, his new book, And They All Sing, Adventures of Eclectic Disc Jockey. He has spoken to some of the key artists, musicians. You were speaking about Leonard Bernstein. Let me have you put your professor cap, compare and contrast. What does Leonard Bernstein have to do with Bob Dylan? Why would you put him in the same book?
Well, that's the whole point. They're not. He's in a chapter called Composers, and it's Aaron Copland in American music, folk and American music, his own. First there's classical, and then there's the vox humana, the human voice. So I have several singers I knew very well. Some of the interviews took place 40 years ago, 45 years ago, yet a very contemporary. And you go from, and then you get the old, marvelous old guitarist who made the guitar, classic guitar, accepted fully, Andre Segovia. And he's playing, say, for 5,000 people in Ann Arbor. Just an 85-year-old guy on a classic guitar, very softly. And one of his listeners comes up at the end and says, "Maestro, you were great, except for one thing. You played so softly. I had to listen so intently and lean forward." And then Segovia says to me, "As a result of which, next time I played even more softly." So this is what it's about. They're talking about certain things they haven't talked about before, their approach. That's classical music. And then we come to the idea of jazz. And Louis Armstrong, so tired, so worn out, not with a grin, no, but sort of he has to follow through because he told his agent he will play at this place, a horrible place in Chicago. They didn't care about jazz. They wanted go-go girls. And now he's still playing, keeping his word. He describes his adventures in Ghana, in West Africa. He suddenly discovers where his music came from and where he came from, and suddenly he comes to life. You got Dizzy Gillespie talking to himself and Charlie Parker working on a new form, new approach to the instrument called bop, bebop. But then we come to a third aspect of it, folk song and its revival. And there's young Bob Dylan, 40 years ago. He's 20 years old. And is speaking, and he's just a young kid trying to get his words through, how much he admired Woody Guthrie, whom I knew very well, by the way. In a sequence about Woody in it. I got him between Woody and Pete Seeger and have Bob Dylan there who spoke of his worship of Woody. And then he sings a song, an early one of his songs called Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. He says every line could be a song in itself. And the one line that most fascinated me, the line was, and the executioner's face is always well hidden. You start thinking of the guillotine, and the axeman's face has a mask, hangman, and today with technology, both. The technology works two ways. I'm here today talking to you. I should be dead. I should have been dead 20, 30, 40 years ago, because my father and my two brothers, both, all three died in the 50s of angina, which I had. But there was an operation. There was surgery. Skilled hands of a surgeon, but there's the machinery. And recently, at 93, I had a valve removed, a heart valve. I guess I'm the oldest guy in that hospital ever who had a heart valve removed at 93. And all I remember is the machinery. And the surgeon at the end wheeling me out on a gurney, and I look up at him, and he says, it's all over, Studs. I said, you mean I'm dead? I'm officially dead. He says, no, no, it worked out fantastic. You got four more years, at least. 4 more years? That sounds like Nixon's slogan. Now, I'll take a couple. And so I got a couple of more years.
When did you have the surgery, Studs?
Well, that surgery was about 8 weeks ago.
Eight weeks.
The point I'm making is I was saved by machinery that was made by the same species, the human species, that gave us Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And God knows what else these loonies have in store for us. So it can be worked two ways. The new machinery for the advancement of life, for the enrichment of life, at the same time that can destroy millions at one crack. And so we live at a certain moment of choice. Now, this book is about musical artists. What's it got to do with it? It's got everything to do with it. Because when Caruso sang, he's the unsung hero of the book. The couple of old-time divas I interviewed years ago who sang with Caruso. And they speak of his generosity of spirit. He created a phonograph, the Victrola, which some old people may remember, the slogan, a little dog listening to his master's voice, the horn. That came about because of Caruso's generosity. And Caruso's voice was such that the poet John Chardy, by the way, in those days, 1904, 1905, a great migration from the Mediterranean, from Eastern Europe, Italian, Jewish immigrants, and all others came, they'd buy a Caruso record. They made little dough. The Caruso record was $2, which is like $100 today. But they wanted that voice. And John Chardy, the poet, says, the reason is there's something about him that says we're capable of more than you think, because Caruso had a certain high note, saying Celesta Aida, a certain high, and that's as far as we could go. He'd go one step beyond it. And Chardy said, it's telling us, so-called ordinary people, a phrase I dislike because it's patronizing, but the non-celebrated people, that they are capable of more than they think. And this applies to taste in politics as well as taste in music. It applies to taste and remembrance of past so they can best remember and understand a present and hopefully a future.
You know, Studs Terkel, if I could just jump in here and tell people
sure,
that
please.
They are listening to you. Studs Terkel, you've got a brand new book, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Beautiful revelatory dialogues with some of the key musicians, singers, composers of the over five decades that you were out there, Studs Terkel, taking notes. And it is good to have you with us on our Flashpoint show here on Pacifica Radio. And I do want you're making this connection between why artists in a time of, say, war. You talked about the hooded executioner. Now the hooded executioner is at 35,000 feet, dropping white phosphorus and napalm on villages in Iraq. So that's where you're going. And you've spoken to people who have really put this together, who have given us a way to think about some of the most important political, social, cultural issues of our time in a way that's not just journalism on the page.
Well, of course, that's, you said it so beautifully. I have nothing to add to that. Something the artist does who lift the spirits of others but connect with the world outside. This book was ready in the year 2005, all set. In fact, I'm going to a party across the street because I finally got the finished galleys of this book. Now, it's a year ago. And I'm walking down this step, and suddenly I trip, and I do a tour jeté, but I don't land on point. It's as though it was not choreographed by George Balanchine, but by Bob Fosse. It was jazzy. And so for 1 second and a half, I was in the air. And suddenly my neck, my head, hits the siding, and I broke my neck. And so I'm in this hospital in this bed for 7-8 weeks, and that's when the doc said, "It's about to get out, that I got this bad ticker, the valve," and they did that. So this book was ready a long time ago. I'm still around to talk about it.
I would love you to talk about, there's so many questions I have for you, Studs Terkel. I know your time
Keep
is limited,
going.
But I'd love you to talk about Janis Joplin.
Well, what can we say about Janis Joplin? She was a certain spirit. She came out of an oily town, a town she disliked so much, Port Arthur, Texas. She knew there's more to life than what was there. And so her parents couldn't figure her out. She had this vitality. She had this sense of life. Now, I remember the interview. You know, these days, many old-time ballrooms are empty during the day. But at weekends, they're taken with Latino groups or other groups playing. And so she's performing in one of these halls. And the kids there are all stoned. They're stoned. They don't know where they are. It's in the dark. And up in the light is Janis. And she had a little too much Southern comfort. I remember she offered me a drink of Southern comfort, which I disliked very much because it was so sweet. But it wasn't that. She needed something else. Kris Kristofferson wrote the great song that was her great, one of the best ever, Me and Bobby McGee. It's got a line in there that's made for her, that's made for all people who are put upon. And the line is, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." It's a line you can't beat. That was Kristofferson's line. On stage, you have this very live person who understands. She doesn't quite understand, but is trying to understand African-American music and the singers of the blues. And she catches on as well as any white woman possibly could. And here are young fans, so stoned out. I'll never forget that scene.
And she finds herself in the book really in nice company with Mahalia Jackson.
Yeah, well, Mahalia, of course. And there's another story. I've got to tell you this story. I am the one, especially of a middle-aged black people, and Mahalia herself say, "I have helped make her." That's I'm wrong. In fact, the writer of gospel music, the top writer named Professor Thomas A. Dorsey, who once was a blues pianist, and then his wife died, and then he was saved theologically, and he wrote gospel music. And you know, gospel music differs from spirituals, and that's in the book. gospel music came after the Civil War. It came up north, and I first heard you sing a song called Move On Up a Little Higher. I never heard a voice like that nor a song like that. Dorsey wrote that for her, and he wrote Precious Lord, Take My Hand, which was Martin Luther King's favorite song, and Mahalia was his favorite singer. And so black people by the millions knew of her, but I was the first white, I emphasize this, white disc jockey. And so they associated my playing her with being known, which of course is wrong. As you know, I have a big mouth. You know, it's hard to get a word in. And so during the days of early Chicago television, and my program, of course, that place was one of the three programs. This is 1949. It's a new medium, 6 to 10 at night. And then the second was Kugler, Fran, and Ollie, which was in the hands of a genius named Bert Tilstrom. These were puppets, the Kuglerpolitan players, with the one-toothed dragon. And once I substituted for the one human face on the show, Fran Allison, and what an experience it was. 10 feet away from me, behind the stage, is Bert Tilstrom, this human being, who, with his hands and his voice, creates a whole world of people called the Kuglerpolitans, a world of tenderness and of understanding. And one is a woman named Madame Ophelia Oglepuss, and she's two little things in his hand, two little rags in his hand. And I'm talking of Ophelia Oglepuss, but I forget about him. I was so taken with these things in his hand, and so I thought it was this actual woman. So I said, Madame Oglepuss, you are the arbiter of culture of this town. Dear boy, call me Ophelia, and I'm in awe of her. Ophelia, didn't you once sing Tosca? How did you know that, dear boy? Some compared me to Madame Callas, and I think perhaps it was a fair comparison. So I believed her. What we had in common was improvisation. We were jazzy. But then I got in trouble, right? The Cold War begins, World War II is over, and I'm at rallies. My name is there, petitions for the Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, those who fought against Franco, the fascist who overthrew, with the help of Hitler and Mussolini, a legally elected government. And so they fled, and so it was to help them or civil rights before Martin Luther King. So one day a guy from New York says, Stutt, you are valuable property. I was caught in New York, as the announcer Mike Wallace was. And he says, we're in trouble. So I thought to myself, where do you get that we stuff? It's like Tonto talking Lone Ranger when it's surrounded by Indians. We're in trouble. And he says, where do you get that we stuff? He says, your name is on all these petitions. I said, that's right. Well, don't you know they were sponsored by the commies, by communists? And that's when I get cute now and then. I said, suppose communists come out against cancer. Do we have to automatically come out for it? And he says, it's not very funny. And then he said, you got to stand up and be counted these days. So I do a Charlie Chaplin, whom I loved, and I stand up. And he says, sit down, that's not funny either. Finally, he says, why don't you recant? All you got to say is you were duped. And I wasn't. You see, what saved me was my ego. I can't say I was dumb when I wasn't.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music breaks, The Welfare Poets, Let It Be Known, and Casey Neal with Brooklyn Bridge. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.